The Science Inside Podcast. This is The Science Inside.
Good evening. This is The Science Inside, and I am your host, Bridget Lebere. And every week, as you can imagine, we bring you the latest news and events around science. So we keep you updated on what's happening around your area and internationally. So, as we are trying to update you on these events, the Council for Science and Industrial Research, which is the CSIR, has in the recent weeks held a showcase of the future roadmap of what human settlements could look like in the future. The Department of Science and Technology, together with the CSIR, are developing a roadmap on how to adopt science and tech-driven innovation for South Africa's future housing and neighborhoods. And this strategic framework recognizes the demand and the need for alternative and innovative technologies being built into the environment to help achieve citizens' rights to adequate housing and improved quality of life. And as part of the definition process for the roadmap project, the CSIR recently hosted this off-the-wall human settlements showcase, where it featured a two-day open-air fair event environment at which technologies were demonstrated and discussed in length with human settlement stakeholders from various public and private sectors. And the University of the Witwatersrand also had a seminar of their own looking at how the future of housing can be planned for from an architectural perspective. But there's more on this later on in the show, and we look in depth at all of this. And on Facebook, we are The Science Inside, and our WhatsApp line is 084-078-4912. You can also tweet us at VowFM, hashtag Science Inside. And next up, as we do, as always, we have Masibulele Lunika, who will take us through the news that have been taking place in the science world. Good evening, Masibulele.
Good evening, Bridget. And our news-making headlines: China gene editing experiment points to new stroke treatment, and new research questions ethics of eliminating entire species of disease-causing pests, and popular SA contraceptive could weaken your immune system. Good evening, I'm Masibulele Lunika with the Science Inside News. Last year's contentious gene-edited twins experiment may hold other benefits for brain injury, according to a new study. A widely criticized experiment last year saw a researcher in China delete a gene in twin girls, at the embryonic stage in an attempt to protect them against HIV. A new study by researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, David Goffin School of Medicine, suggests that using a drug to delete the same gene in people with stroke or traumatic brain injuries could help improve their recovery. The study studies human validation component, The team examined 68 individuals without CCR5 genes, along with 446 controls. Those who suffered from strokes and also had the natural gene deletion recovered movement abilities faster and had fewer cognitive deficits months after the stroke than did patients who had the CCR5 gene. This approach uses a drug that deletes the gene rather than an actual removal at an embryonic stage. The combined results suggest that the drug might boost recovery in humans after a stroke or traumatic brain injury, says S. Thomas Carmichael, the study's senior researcher and neurologist. His team has started a follow-up human study to test the drug's efficacy. In healthy people, the CCR5 gene is thought to promote learning and memory by acting as a stop signal, telling neurons to receive only one memory and hold it, rather than continuing to receive and retain every signal that comes in. Carmichael says, immediately after a stroke or brain injury, the gene helps to tempt to tamp rather down the excitability of neurons, helping to limit damage, he says. But if the gene keeps pumping out stop signals, it also interferes with the brain's ability to build new connections and repair damage, he adds. Carmichael's approach is to turn off these signals by starting people on the drug about 5 to 7 days after a stroke and continuing for about 3 months, allowing the brain a better chance to recover. The work shows the benefits of turning off the gene in stroke-induced mice by using the drug already approved as an HIV treatment. It also focuses on a sample of people who are naturally born without the gene. People without the gene recover faster and more completely from stroke than the general population does, the researchers found. In late 2018, He Jiankui, then at the Southern University of Science and Technology in China, said he had edited the CCR5 genes of twin girls at an embryonic stage in an effort to protect them against HIV infection. The first of its kind outcome was apparently healthy twin girls born without CCR5, he said. Wildlife species harmful to humans are often targets of control and elimination programs. A new study questions the ethics behind the idea of killing off entire species. The study, titled The Ethics of Eliminating Harmful Species, The Case of the Tsetse Fly, looks at the contemporary case of the tsetse fly, a vector of sleeping sickness and African animal trypanosomosis. The study was worked on by 4 scientists, including Neil H. Carter, Human Environment Systems at Boise State University in Boise, Idaho, and Chelsea Botavia, Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society at Oregon University, State University, in Corvallis. Michael Paul Nelson at the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society at Oregon State University. Jeremy Boyer at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tsetse flies have recently been targeted by a Pan-African eradication campaign. If it is successful, the campaign could push the entire tsetse fly family to extinction. With the emergence of effective and efficient elimination technologies, the research suggests that ethical assessment of proposed elimination campaigns is urgently needed. Sleeping sickness or trypanosomiasis, endemic in sub-Saharan Africa, is a horribly debilitating disease. When the parasitic protozoan that causes it gets into the nervous system and brain, weeks or months after being transmitted by the blood-eating tsetse fly, it sends the victim into a steep decline marked by depression, aggressiveness, psychotic behavior, disrupted sleep patterns, and, if untreated, death. Happily, a concerted multinational effort has reduced the reported incidence of disease by 92% in this century, from 26,550 cases in 2000 to just 2,164 cases in 2016. That puts the fight against sleeping sickness on track to meet the World Health Organization's goal of eliminating it by 2020, according to a study published in December in PLOS Neglected Tropical Diseases. Thanks to increasingly sophisticated methods of reducing the population of tsetse flies, the area where people are at risk of infection has also decreased by 61% in the same period. Why not just finish the job and end sleeping sickness by eradicating the tsetse fly from the entire African continent, you ask? This is the stated goal of the African Union's Pan-African Tsetse Fly Trypanosomiasis Eradication Campaign. But the study, published in December in Bioscience, calls for re-examining that approach. The important ethical question remains, is tsetse fly elimination morally appropriate? Entomologist Jeremy Bowyer and his co-authors wrote, the study lays out a protocol for properly considering a question that is less simple and more momentous than it seems at first glance, says Bowyer, who spent 7 years in tsetse fly control in Senegal and now works on pest control programs for the International Atomic Energy Agency. For one thing, tsetse fly eradication is not about getting rid of a single species, but rather an entire taxonomic family called Glossinidae, with 31 species and subspecies across Africa. Conservationists commonly eradicate introduced or invasive species from inhabitants where they do not belong. But tsetse flies are native to Africa, and the study notes, and they have a complex biology and unique evolutionary history.
This is the Science Inside.
Recapping your top stories this hour, biology at the center of last year's contentious gene-edited twins results may hold other benefits for brain injury. A new study by researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, at the David Goffin School of Medicine suggests that using a drug to delete the same gene in people with stroke or traumatic brain injuries could help improve their recovery. And wildlife species harmful to humans are often targets of control and elimination programs. A new study questions the ethics behind the idea of killing off entire species of disease-causing pests. So imagine an app that can give you an entire building status in condition, its condition rather, lifespan, etc. This is one of the innovations that we could potentially see in our future homes. There are many other ideas like it, but the big topic is what to expect for the future of housing in general, and what are some of the key concerns we should be having from a scientific point of view. Earlier this month, many similar scientific and technological innovations and ideas were showcased at the Off the Wall Technology Showcase. To find out more about them, or whether they are in fact even possible, we spoke to Peter Dejega, a CSIR project leader and senior researcher with the Architectural and Engineering Building and Tech Sciences Wing, who tells us more, starting with the question of why housing is so important to look at particularly.
We're not doing terribly well with housing, particularly in South Africa. You'll be aware that we have sort of private sector takes care of a number of people, the free market, and people who can afford to purchase houses on the free market do that. But we have a lot of people who aren't able to do that, and then they are essentially served by the public sector through various mechanisms. You know, we commonly refer to an RDP house or a BNG house, which is a sort of standard four-roomed freehold building, which is fantastic. It's dignifying for somebody who gets such a house or thing. But it's got a number of problems with it, because with that model, or would that be the only model? One thing is, at the moment, we have in South Africa about 54 million people, 57 million people living here. But by 2050, we're going to have between 75 million and 80 million people. And those people are going to increasingly be concentrated in cities and towns. So at the moment, we're developing a backlog of housing. And the houses that we produce under those models, the RDP and BNG models, tend to be on the margins of the existing cities. That means that we're literally concretizing, marginalizing people on the edges. It makes it very difficult to provide schools, health services, and jobs within the proximity of very sprawled out urban areas. So one of the major ways in which science, technology, and innovation can help us is to relook at the models that we use for the provision of housing. Then also we can look at, we're working towards climate change. In 2050, again, we'll be looking at a minimum of 2 degrees. Probably your climate model is at WITS will tell you that South Africa is actually probably looking at between 3 and 6 degrees more hot by the turn of the century than it is now. And, we really need to be designing energy-efficient built environments, and we need to make houses which are comfortable in built environments, human habitats which are healthy and where we can be productive and happy. So there, again, science, technology, and innovation has got a lot of possibility for making, better quality homes through advanced materials and so on. And then, there are so many ways. We can also look at how through the fourth industrial revolution, we change the nature of jobs. We use advanced manufacturing and so on, because the construction industry is one of the best employers of people in South Africa. But it's also one where people may not have the best, they may not always be the most decent jobs. They're not always the ones we would love to have, are construction jobs,
Yeah.
So how can science, technology, and innovation improve the way that we put houses together and construct them?
Yes.
Or housing, not houses. So there's another way that we can use these, innovation for a better future.
Tejega says the built environment is a conservative industry and tends to do things the same way, insisting on bricks and mortar to build houses. However, global risks such as climate change require governments to rethink how resources are managed. The proposed roadmap is aimed at using science and technology and innovations to respond to these risks, Tejega notes, with an initial focus in RDP houses. The project also aims to bridge the gap between rural and urban settlements in efforts to improve quality of life. Peter also gives us an idea of what are some of the burning concerns in housing that need to be looked at from a scientific point of view.
Energy efficiency is sort of very topical at the moment because we're suffering a little bit with some interruptions to our power security. But water scarcity, resource scarcity generally is something which we really need to keep our eyes open about. Remember, I said we're looking at a world of 75 million people in South Africa. Already, more than 30% of our water resources are stretched, badly stretched. So we seriously need to look at how we manage our water resources going forward. I think transport, some very interesting innovations are likely to come in a disruptive form if we let go of our desires, our preferences to have cars, our own cars. Maybe that's a silly luxury that we should really rethink. We're talking about aspirations here, but do we really all need a car? And then, what is the implications for the city if we rethink mobility? So we think we want to move around in the city. Mobility is good, but what can the form of that be? And you think about models like Uber or Airbnb, or I think about blockchain technology and so on. Where and the public transport system in South Africa we have kind of very old ways of thinking about mobility in the city.
Yeah.
To drive a car you must be 18 years old and sober. Whereas maybe the city needs to be you need mobility in the city even if you're a child or elderly or something like that. So. Yeah. We the way that we apply technology marginalizes people at the moment.
Yeah.
We're gonna most likely end up with older people. At the moment, we have a lot of youth, but in the next 50 years, we are likely to go the way of other. As we become a developed nation and so on, we're likely to have older people in our communities rather than just young youth.
Yeah.
And how do our cities accommodate those people? And then what are you leaving behind in the rural areas? You know, these are our security for food. What is our food security like if we have hollowing out rural areas? You know, how do we create livelihoods throughout the country that have got good quality and that are accessible to everybody?
Yeah.
Our problem at the moment is the way that things are structured. We have a lot of people who are excluded from the economy. So one of the interesting innovations that we've come across during looking at this in the showcase is people who are re-looking, obviously, at construction waste, which is wonderful, and looking at the circular economy and how we can think of waste as a resource instead of as a problem. And other things around that are to look at financial models for backyard shacks. So trying to improve the quality of the infrastructure of backyard shacks by innovative financing models. So you can get somebody to invest in your backyard shack, share in the rent for a couple of years, and then you own that upgraded piece of infrastructure, which will bring additional value to your property. So that's an innovation, which is just a small financial, it's a business innovation, not a technology per se. But it's got the possibility of really unlocking, that helping people to access better quality.
The definition phase is technically due to be finished between September and 31 March of 2020, according to her, and adds that the department is already in conversation with its partners to co-create the definition. The implementation phase is from next March and over the next 10 years. We find out if whether these innovations are ready for the mainstream housing market or vice versa.
It's probably not yet ideal. I mean, I guess there is some investment in patches here and there, but I wouldn't say that it's a solid, mature kind of industry. It's not something where people feel they're going to, you know, there's just generally a lack of confidence, I suppose, in the future. And Capital Works is a vote for the future and a vote for certainty and if you can, it's not seen as a quick win or an easy one, so it's probably not something that people will invest in large numbers unless they start to show big uptake, you know. And it's fascinating, people's habits are so interesting. I've got a slide, I can't remember, it's something like 4% of South Africans have got solar geysers, right? 4%. But 40% of us have got pay TV.
Wow.
So our priorities are a little bit weird. We aren't, no matter what we say about our love for the environment and whatever, where we put our money is not necessarily in support of what we're saying. And then it's the same thing with cell phone technology. Nobody had to tell you to buy a smartphone. I assume you have one.
Yeah.
But nobody had to tell you that you had to buy that because this technology sold itself. It was such cool technology. You wanted that.
Yeah.
And I think we need to get to that point with our human settlements. We don't want to tell people that they are supposed to want to live in a flat in Hillbrow, because it's actually from an environmental point of view, from a quality of life point of view, it's in their best interest. No, you have to make that flat in Hillbrow so cool, people will go there and, you know, the market takes you there. That's, I think, how are we going to unlock this a bit? And that means that we're not just looking at the government departments. We actually really need to look at public and private sector investment. And we do really have to work with the public, not just with government.
The event featured exhibitions and pitching sessions. Entrepreneurs, innovators, and industry in the country used the opportunity to showcase new ideas for future houses and neighborhoods. Selected projects will be featured in a book, while all exhibited innovations will be documented in a register, which forms part of the broader road mapping initiative.
So the whole road map project is to actually look at. We're in the definition phase, which is sort of a two-year phase, and this off-the-wall event was essentially one of the last of the first consultation round, and it was aimed specifically at looking at the innovators, at industry, etc. So we've widely consulted with government across the provinces and with academia, etc. Now, we actually want to sit and work on a 10-year plan, which will start, in the next 6 to 12 months. And that 10-year plan is meant to get all of the role players who can, work on this and improve it to work together. Because at the moment, what we find is you'll get one guy doing a part, you'll get Bongo working on something at this, and once she graduates, her project gets shelved, and then she moves on with her life. Yeah. So there's a lot of beautiful work that's being done in the universities that is being piloted, very across the country. But there's not always ways of scaling that up. So we that's what the roadmap, the purpose of the roadmap project is to do, is to actually set a program for. At least getting some of the stuff to grow and to succeed, and to get that pipeline going. So the off the wall thing, technology showcase. Look at what the people who participated got really good media exposure. They got some mentorship because there was for example a pitching session on the Saturday. A number of people had never pitched their technology before, so they were learning through that program. Yeah. There were a number of public lectures on procurement of innovative building technologies, because it's not straightforward. It's not as easy to procure a building with a different sort of a brick substance than in a brick, because the one is quite easy to do and the other one's a little bit more difficult. And how to do a certification process for a non-standard building supplier. So there were a lot of masterclasses that were presented, so that was very attractive to consultants and implementing people over there in the sector. And then one of the guys actually got an order for 5,000 units for his product. So they did. I think it was worthwhile. It's not just about.
Just hearing what's on.
So that we understand the constraints of the suppliers for the roadmap. That's very important. That was our objective, but it was worthwhile, I think, for the participants as well.
Wow.
The road mapping project. There is a project website. I assume you may have come across it, which is www.sti4shs.co.za. We're essentially calling that the national forum. So as we're developing this roadmap, we're engaging with people who are registered there. We're, distributing our documents and drafts there. So if anybody wants to participate, wants to get their voice heard, wants to get sight of those drafts and what have you, I encourage them then to actually register online. Even if we can't solve their particular problem, at least we can try and make a better future.
According to the Science and Technology and Innovation for Sustainable Human Settlements website, science and technology and innovation has the potential to contribute to the achievement of the National Development Plan, Sustainable Development Goals, Integrated Urban Development Framework, and the New Urban Agenda in South African human settlement sector. The potential of STI, however, is limited by lack of decision support, investment, and prevalent conservatism in the sector. data, which frustrates uptake of promising technology. CSIR is encouraging people to participate in these types of events as it tries to get all the emerging ideas to see some daylight and hopes to continue these conversations. I am Masibulela Luniga with the Science Inside News.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside, and now we step right into it, our favorite part in the show. It's time for Unscience. We look at the strangest side of research and where they find all of these ideas, and we look at the weird, the wonderful side of the sciences and what scientists actually spend their time and a lot of their money and efforts on. And yes, Masibulele, you have the Unscience story for us this evening.
Yes.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Do you remember algebra in school? Math was as easy as 2 plus 2 equals 4. Then they went and they just had to make things complicated by adding letters of the alphabet to it.
Man, you're telling me I could tell you a thing or two about the complexities that come with solving for X. It makes me only wonder, why do we even bother?
I see you have jokes, hey? Well, complex mathematical calculations are an everyday thing for some animals in the animal kingdom. A new research study, as published by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem by Dr. Alon Zaslava and his team, revealed that some animals perform mathematical calculations to find their next meal.
What? That is totally absurd. I mean, well, I've never had to use algebra or trigonometry to find my house keys or find the matching partner to a long-lost sock. But imagine the possibilities if only humans could apply the same strategies to finding food. I mean, imagine the possibilities of what this would mean actually for thousands of people living in the streets and those who go to bed on a hungry stomach daily. I can already see someone making a business out of this, because I would fail every time and I would have to pay somebody every time I solved for X wrongly, yeah. You know? But I would just basically die, you know, from hunger.
Yeah, that would really be something else. Maybe it would actually force us to improve our math.
Perhaps, but I'm pretty sure there would be a very little population left. I mean, this would be some pretty intense work from the Department of Education and all of that. And imagine what the turnaround strategy would have to be for the education system with all the math literacy happening in schools right now. But tell me more about this research.
Yeah, no, this study was performed on C. elegans, pronounced as C. elegans, worms, and it was discovered that these worms employ a sniffing method to locate their food.
Okay, but how does the mathematical part fit into this equation?
Math equation, Bridget, stop with the puns and please be serious for just a minute. Apparently, it is like the hot or cool game. You're in a doghouse and a chocolate cake has been taken out of the oven. So obviously, to find the cake, you would probably have to sniff your way in the direction of the cake, of the cake scent, right?
Right. But then what happens next? Does it calculate its path using algebraic geometry typology next?
Yes, kind of. So there's a neural cell in their brains that is activated, which acts like a function called the waves recalculating root function. This cell then senses derivatives, meaning it calculates the odor intensity. It then classifies it according to positive, getting hotter, getting colder, or negative. If by any chance it calculates that it is negative, it means that it is moving further away from the cake and it would then have to recalculate its route. Should it calculate a positive, then it would continue on the path.
All right, that is very enlightening, I must say. But I wish I could do similar things with my brain to solve such problems, you know?
Yes, but that's not all. The cell continues to calculate more data on the smell to detect whether the current odor intensity is getting stronger or weaker. Then it puts together a chart with the new differential measures as backup. Humans, however, do not use this system as they are more complex compared to this worm.
This sounds like one of those mathematical problems that require you to solve for two values of X. It seems like these worms are not as simple as we thought they are.
Yep. Dr. Zaslevar concluded that these worms could teach us an important lesson. He says that when looking at solving a math problem, a quick solution is attractive. However, we need a backup, a system to ensure that we are moving in the right direction. Wiggle, wiggle, wiggle.
Wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. Great, and that was unusual, unlikely, unscience. Well, next up, we have a story. We are looking at a green company that is changing the face of the water heating industry while meeting the energy efficiency needs. But hang tight, we return after the break.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. This is the Science Inside.
Once more, a very warm welcome to you to the Science Inside. And if you're only tuning in now, where have you been? You've missed the majority of the show, but you're just in time for my story. And earlier on, we engaged on a topic that concerns all of us, really, the issue of housing settlements and on how science, technology and innovation can be used to improve all aspects of our living spaces. And with that being said, I interviewed Sandi Swatkai, the founder and managing director of AET Africa. It pays special attention to energy conservation, reusing and developing an alternative water heating solutions for Africa's special ecological and socio-economic needs. And this factory is in Dimbaza in King William's Town in the Eastern Cape, and it was launched in 2012, where it received money around or amounting to about 7 million rands. And this is Sandi Swatkai adding more to what their company does.
AET Africa, we are innovators and manufacturers of energy efficiency projects. The two leading innovations that support in the energy efficiency will be a hotspot and heat radar. What we focus on as a company in terms of energy efficiency is water heating space by providing retrofit solutions in terms of how to reduce electricity consumption of your existing user, but at the same time also come up with innovations that can improve the energy efficiency of geysers going forward, which is these new geysers that are going to come into the market. We've got our own manufacturing plant at this stage, a set up manufacturing plant for hotspot. We are in the process of doing that even for heat radar.
The company's main objective is to produce high-quality, innovative and energy-efficient products, which are clean while meeting the needs of urban informal communities that are financially strapped and are currently overwhelmed by hefty electricity bills.
I used to wake up every morning at 4:30 to switch my geyser on so that I can have access to hot water at 6:30 because I couldn't afford to keep my geyser on the whole day. And the situation at my home is that it was me and my daughter and my helper. Then I'll wake up and then we take a shower with my daughter in the morning, and the helper will take a shower perhaps in the afternoon. So the switching on and off and the geyser sometimes forgetting to switch it on because I don't have a timer. That's what led me to come up with a hotspot innovation concept.
It is an impactful innovation. It is a long funnel resembling plastic sleeve made with special liquid plastic called plastisol. The high quality of the plastic ensures longevity under intense hot temperatures over lengthy periods in the water.
In terms of the design, my focus is more on coming up with the concept. And then my technical partner, Michael Roma, looked into how we can configure the hotspot device in terms of working on the current user configuration. As a concept, what it aims to do is to improve your energy efficiency of your existing geyser, and then also allow you as a customer to heat the volume of hot water you need when you need it. Because the current geyser design is that even if you need 50 liters, the way the geyser is designed is that every day you're heating 150 liters or 200 liters of hot water, which most of the time, if it's only two people in the house, you don't normally finish that hot water. So you pay for excess water, which you don't normally finish when you switch your geyser on and off. But at the same time, even if you keep your geyser on, because of repeated reheating and heat losses, your geyser continues to consume electricity in the background. So that's when, then, in terms of the specification for the design of the hot water, besides the switching on and off, still have access to that water, but it also needs to have a unique value proposition in such a way that you can operate with either like a kettle. You heat the volume of hot water you need whenever you need it.
It is able to heat up to 50 liters of water in just 30 minutes, slashing the proportional time it would take for you to access your hot water by 1.5 hours, and this is in comparison to the amount of water that the conventional geyser is able to heat in the tank.
For example, if you've got 150-liter 3-kilowatt element geyser, they are categorized in terms of your insulation and heat losses. So in ordinary geyser, 3-kilowatt element, it takes you on average 1.5 hours to 2 hours for you to get hot water when you switch that geyser off. And then let's say you start at room temperature of 21 degrees Celsius. So what happens is, as soon as you switch that geyser on, your hot water will start to rise until a stage where that water will be diluted and becomes lukewarm, which is why it takes you longer to get that hot water. But in the case of the hot spot, when you retrofit your geyser with hot spot, as soon as that hot water is heated by the element at the bottom of your geyser, that hot water is pushed through the hot spot to rise so that it is closer to the outlet. And then your hot water then is constantly sucked in to be at the bottom of the geyser.
The thermal siphon technology, which gives the hot spot its unique value proposition, mimics diodide heat pipes. It disables heat from being transferred in the reverse direction from the radiator heater pipes to the cold end of the Stirling converter, thus pushing the heated water closer to the water supply outlet for consumption. The thermosiphon length can be limitless. Thus, it carries more power than a heat pipe, even with the same diameter. The marvel behind this technology, really, is that it is assisted by gravity, which in turn helps to return the condensate, which is why it only operates when it is tilted.
The hot spot it uses is what you call thermosiphon, whereby different densities in your hot water and your cold water, the hot spot works as a funnel to suck in your cold water to be positioned at the bottom because it's dense. And then through the design of the hotspot, it flows in that water, so it pushes your hot water to rise because it's lighter in density, meaning that your cold water and hot water, they don't mix, and then it creates the stratification or the layers of hot water on the top and then your cold water at the bottom. And then it's also designed it in such a way that you can retrofit on any type of geyser where you've got a spiral element, be it a horizontal and a vertical geyser. And our test, when we did the proof of concept, showed that within 30 minutes, you can have access to 50 liters, 50 degrees of hot water. And then if you don't switch your geyser on and off, on monthly basis, you can save up to 27% of your energy consumption. That is reheating the same water in your 10-15 liters, 3-kilowatt element, without switching your geyser on and off. So you're still saving about 27% of your energy.
Being in the water heating sector, the company is also looking at adding another product that will assist people in the informal settlements to have low pressure geysers, which are usually slow and not self-regulatory. And this innovation is currently only in its conceptual phase.
Currently, every 20 minutes, you can produce about 30 units of hotspot. And then on monthly basis, you can push up to 10,000 units. That's our production capacity from our factory. But of course, because now we're still new in the market, so we don't have enough sales volume. We haven't produced the 10,000 units as of yet. But our plan is for the capacity of producing 10,000 units on a monthly basis.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on the Science Inside.
Yes, this is indeed the Science Inside, but we have come to the end of our show. Thanks a lot to all of our guests who are featured on the show, including Sandi Swatlai, Peter Dajega, and our team behind the scenes, production by Glory Mabuza, Masibulele Lunika, and none other than our tech producer, Kutwano Serame. Our podcast is on journalism.co.za/science and social media, Facebook as The Science Inside. Tweet us at Vow FM as well. And The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy. It is funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. And that is all from our desk tonight. Catch up with you next week, same time on Monday.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on Vow FM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.